listening to the Mental Health Download from the nonprofit Mental Health Association Oklahoma. I'm Addie McCasland. Today, I am talking with Cheryl Stepp, founder and owner of Creating Resilience, a training and consulting company. Cheryl has extensive knowledge on the impact of adverse childhood experiences known as ACEs, as well as experience training and coaching about the impact of trauma. She speaks expertly on the framework of strategies that build a foundation to respond and empower people to create collective well-being. Cheryl also consults with leadership to build trauma-informed agencies. Previously, she was a school counselor for 17 years. Cheryl is a licensed professional counselor and nationally board-certified counselor who is also certified in traumatic stress studies and attachment, self-regulation and competence, also known as ARC, trauma treatment for children and adolescents. Additionally, Cheryl was one of our 2023 Zero Mental Health Symposium presenters. I am thrilled to have Cheryl on today, and I hope you enjoy the dialogue surrounding ACEs and the impact of childhood trauma. The Mental Health Download starts now.
Welcome, Cheryl. You want to tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do?
Sure. I work with my own company, a training and consulting company called Creating Resilience. I came about to do that work through being a school counselor in public schools for 17 years. And I worked in pre-K through 12th grade school for 5 years and a pre-K through fifth grade school for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And after that great career working with all those kids and students, and I did preventative classes as well as one-on-one counseling and group counseling and then consulting with teachers and parents, mm-hmm. I went to work for a nonprofit called Trauma Smart for a couple of years. And it's a great nonprofit. And I traveled from the state of New York to the state of Oregon, working with Head Start teachers and elementary teachers to help them understand adverse childhood experiences mm-hmm. and trauma and stress, how that impacts our brain and our body and our behaviors and our reactions and responses in the world. And then how to build systems and relationships and skills with other people to help decrease the impact of stress and adversity in our lives. And so when I moved back to Oklahoma with my husband, they said, go start your own thing, Cheryl. You have all the research behind all this, go do it. So I did. And so I've been working in the state of Oklahoma, continue to go back to Michigan and do some work a little bit in Kansas, and just really work with schools and agencies, helping them understand what adversities and trauma and stress do to our brains and bodies. And it's a huge passion of mine to just share the knowledge. I think the awareness of our own brains and the awareness of where other people are in their brains as we're having conversations with them just shifts how you view the world.
Sure. Really cool. Sure.
But what got you into this field to begin with? What sparked your interest?
I just working with kids went a long, long time ago. I laugh because my first career was training horses.
Okay.
I was a hunter jumper, rider and trainer, and my husband was going back to get a specialty degree. And so I had a child psychologist that was one of my students, an adult student. And he said, you know, you really interact well with kids. You really need to work with kids. And so I was like, well, I'll go be a counselor with kids, a youth counselor. And that's what really got me started in it. And then the work in the school systems was just such a passion of mine because I really saw a need of advocating for students and parents. And it was really cool in the elementary schools because some of our kids we'd have for 7 years uh-huh. or even eight. They'd start in pre-K and stay with us. So it was really a great way to see that the impact you're having is cumulative over time, which sometimes in schools when kids are moving from school to school, you don't see what kind of impact you made. So that was really neat too.
You said you worked in schools for 17 years, if I remember that correctly?
That's correct.
When did you start? When did you leave? So when was your last year in the schools?
I believe it was May of 2016. It was my last year and the previous 17 years.
Let's speak to how mental health needs in the schools changed over that time. I mean, surely there was an evolution from the time you first got there until, you know, until 2016.
I think it's continuing to shift and change,
sure.
especially in the last 5 years, a lot.
Yeah.
I just feel like a lot of, there's so many different variables that play into it. I think technology is one. I think just our entire, the way our society is run, and the things that we emphasize in our society and the things we de-emphasize in our society just created this long-term evolution of where we are now. So what I mean by that is we have a lot of cultural things that push certain cultures to drive and strive and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and don't talk about emotions and things like that. And it might seem like that's a great thing to do in the short run, but so much research is showing when you don't understand or express your emotions, you have a lot of physical illness, not just social and mental issues, but a lot of physical illness too. And just beginning to reshape our society to understand it's not all about me. It's not about stepping on others to get ahead. Survival of the fittest. It really, truly, our brains and bodies are created for connection and community. And as we slowly stepped away from that in the 40s and 50s, and even though, you know, the families eating dinner together at night and, you know, everybody got so busy, we lost that connection. And we lost what that does, the good things that does in our bodies and our brains. And I think it's a pendulum swing, right? So it's swinging back now. People are starting to realize through brain research, it's not just, oh, this feels good.
Right.
It truly is a brain research of how much connection and attachment and feeling safe, not just physical, but emotional and social safety. How important that is to keep us physically healthy and keep us being viable citizens. So I just think it's kind of that pendulum swing of, wow, we hit this and we're seeing all these issues coming to rise. What's happening here? And how can we shift and change and move that back? And that's, I think, why I love the work at Trauma Smart, because I had seen that just building in our schools. It was like, you started out first, there might be one or two children and, you know, every classroom maybe, but usually it was like out of four classrooms, you might have two kids that were really struggling in school socially and behaviorally and things like that. To when I was leaving, you know, you were trying to keep that down to three per class.
Sure.
Because you have three kids that demand a lot of teacher attention and they have 25 kids in the class, it gets really difficult. So we did see it rising up. And I do think all the work of University of Harvard, the Center on the Developing Child, Bruce Perry, Bessel van der Kolk, Dan Siegel, all these great, Stephen Porges, great researchers, is showing us, you know, we've got to start shifting and changing relationships and community at the family level and the community level and the national level to really rise above all of this.
Sure. So you mentioned that trauma or mental health struggles or lack of safety can manifest physically. So you feel physically ill. But it sounds like if those issues, if trauma is mitigated, if the mental health struggles are addressed, or if the unsafe feelings are removed and the child feels a sense of safety, it sounds like those physical manifestations would subside. And so they would feel physically healthier.
In the long run, that's what the research is showing. And I guess what we're really, really looking at is we know that if it doesn't subside, that the cortisol, the adrenaline, all those chemicals going through our bodies and hormones going through our body, if that's happening on an ongoing basis, especially, you know, zero to puberty, especially in that time frame, it really shifts and changes how our neural networks in our brains are formed, and it takes a toll on our body. So what they're really saying is if we can decrease the impact of that adversity, create safe places, create supportive relationships, teach the skills of being able to regulate and understand our emotions, then we don't have that adrenaline and that cortisol being put into our system over and over and over again. And that the people that live lives like that do not have as many of these physical cancer, diabetes, you know, any type of thing that creates inflammation in your body. All those sort of things decrease because we aren't constantly having this flow of those chemicals and hormones in our body because we can bring calm.
Sure. When you're working with the kiddos and you're teaching them this sort of emotional regulation, what are some of the techniques that you've found to be useful or that science has found to be useful, valuable for them?
I think the number one thing is becoming aware of yourself. And however that happens, breath work is huge. And with my kiddos, it wasn't like we sat down and, you know, hummed and did deep breathing. It was really just, you know, hey, everybody, we're going to take a deep, silent breath in and then let it out really slowly. You know, and we would do that two times before we would sit down and try to read a book together, have a conversation. And then if I needed them to get creative, then we might get up and do a little bit of movement and then another deep breath so that we could then focus again. So it's those sort of ideas of things that make you feel calmer. Some people, movement helps bring calm, and other people, movement brings a lot of energy. And so you just have to know your own body and try a lot of things. But grounding to our senses, what do I see, taste, smell, hear, sense, feel? Those are great ways to, if somebody is really activated, to kind of bring them back into their present moment really quickly. But as far as the calming piece of it, it differs per person, but breathing, large muscle movement, biceps, quads, abs, work like that. So, you know, moving your arms all the way up and all the way down, or taking deep lunging steps, or squatting and coming up, all that sort of large muscle work can really be helpful too.
So it doesn't have to be intense movement, just movement.
Oh, right. Yes. We had, I shouldn't say, some of my kiddos might be listening, but what, if we had kids that we knew in a certain point of day that that was kind of a triggery part of the day, or you can sense after a while, you can see somebody getting kind of tense, right? So we had, remember the old fat phone books, right? We would get fat phone books from Tulsa, Oklahoma City, and bind them all up so you couldn't tell what they were. They're all wrapped up. And we would just simply say, hey, the office needs you to carry these down. Could you do me that favor? That really helps. That builds connection and a sense of belonging. Can you carry this down to the front office? So these kids are carrying these, you know, books. They're not too heavy, but they're heavy enough that they have to hold on to them. Walk down to the office. The office knew about it. Take them in the back, hand them back. They come back. Just that walking, holding something heavy, using your core to hold that, feeling like you're helping, that gives a sense of belonging. Those things would often just bring a kid all right back down. And, you know, they're good for the next half hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. But just understanding and being aware of where other people's body sensations might be, start to read and learn people, and then be able to put in what we call regulation breaks. So how are we going to help them regulate so that they're moving their body and taking deep breaths?
Yeah, so it would require a teacher or a counselor or whoever is managing the classroom to really pay attention to students as individuals so that you can customize the response, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah. Very much. So you can do some of it preventative. And that's the other thing I really, really promote in schools and Head Starts, is that throughout the day, there's, you know, multiple transitions in a school day. Even within an agency, I'm working with a couple of adult agencies, and you know, there's a lot of different transitions that happen throughout the day. So you can build that regulation into this transition. So if you're taking your kiddos down to what they call specials teachers, like PE or music, as you're walking, you don't just walk down the hallway silently. Maybe you're taking deep lunge steps for a moment, maybe on your tiptoes for a moment. And maybe as a whole class, you take a deep breath before you walk into that classroom. So you've regulated the whole class. And have the students that need a little bit of extra help, then you're really working with them a little more proactively in conjunction to all that preventative work that goes on throughout the day.
Okay.
It does require the teachers to have an understanding of kind of the basics of the brain. And the biggest thing is that if we're functioning out of high emotion or fear, we're really not thinking very well from the front part of our brain. And then all these things we're talking about bring calm, bring safety. And so then we can use the front part of our brain and actually think things through. That's when you can learn. And so it becomes, in my mind, it's very vital to education, especially whether you're a child or an adult, very vital that you have to know how to regulate your body to get yourself in the part of the brain we can actually learn and interact with people with what I call thoughtful response rather than instinctive reactions to what's going on around you.
How much time does it take for a kiddo to learn something like this? Say you're talking a middle schooler. Surely it's not a take a deep breath and this will help regulate you. And then going forward, they're like, oh, I need a deep breath right now.
So. Yeah, not at all. Not all. And it really does depend on the child and their past experience and their age, and depends on a lot of things. I would say if you take just a child that hasn't had a lot of adversity and trauma and stress, if you were doing that several times throughout the day, just as a whole class, within a couple of weeks, they're going to be like, I get this. And they do start sharing it. They've even done that with me teaching my classes. They'd come in and say, Mrs. Stepp, you look a little stressed. Don't we need to take a deep breath right now? And they would actually help me. Okay, that is what I need to do. But I think with the kiddos that have been raised with a lot of adversity, a lot of stress, a lot of trauma, the key with that is what has helped them survive is to be really hypervigilant, is to be on edge and watching and taking care of themselves. So to ask them to be calm feels completely counterintuitive to what's helped them survive in the past. So I think that's a key piece of understanding adversity when you're working with children or young adults or even grown adults that have had a lot of adversity is we think, oh, take a deep breath. Doesn't it help you make you feel calm? But in fact, silence and in a quiet space might actually make them more hypervigilant because that could actually be a trigger for them. So you can't blanket that discussion. I will tell you this. We had some kiddos that it was probably fourth or, you know, beginning of fifth grade that we'd had since pre-K that were finally like, oh, they're getting it. So sometimes it takes years because they have to be able to feel safe and they have to be able to feel like they have that kind of control. And that it's a safe place that allows them to have that kind of calm. And I love that you said earlier that they feel safe because they could be we can be in very safe places. If you looked around and had an objective person, but it might not feel safe to us. And that's a really key piece to all of this.
Yeah. In the interest of transparency, that comes from, you know, personal experience. I grew up in a volatile household and score pretty highly on the ACEs test. And for sure, even as a 47-year-old, have my triggers and my hypervigilance and my, I want to know what's ahead of me. I don't like surprises. And, you know, if somebody's really quiet, then I'm wanting to manage what's wrong. You know, what can I do to make this person not feel whatever it is they're feeling that's making them quiet? And I understand sometimes people are just quiet and quiet can feel unsafe to me. And I have to say, actually, this person is just being quiet. So that comes from personal experience, I should say.
And being aware of yourself and being aware of other people. And I think if we kind of, and that goes back to your first question, if we go through life and this is all about me and I'm going to do what I need to do to get ahead, you're not interacting with other people and understanding yourself and how you're relating to them and how they're relating to you. And that's not good for our brains and bodies. Research has shown us that we are built for connection.
Yeah. Something I've said in my professional life about things that have nothing to do with this is I always find that collaboration over competition is much more effective. And I was having a discussion with somebody recently about how that it definitely applies in a professional realm, in a business realm. But I think it also applies in a personal realm. If you can collaborate with the people around you rather than compete with the people around you, everybody is elevated. You know, it's not, there's not that I'm gesturing my hands so the listeners can see this, but it's, everybody is elevated. It's not, you know, somebody's being pressed down so somebody else can be lifted up. It's just, we're all in it together and elevating each other.
So. Stephen Porges, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a great researcher. And he says, and I love this, that every single interaction we have with people, whether it's like you and I having a conversation or whether it's Congress and US Senate and their relationship with their constituents, every single interaction we have is either about power or it's about connection. And sometimes it needs to be about power. Sometimes there needs to be, you know, a power. But anytime we take the stance or the track of power, it's going to harm the connection piece. And so if you take a stance of power, like even with your own children, you take a stance of power, you know, no, we're not going to jump into that pond right now.
Right.
That there's a slight, you know, sometimes the kid's like, you know, yeah, I'm mad at you, mommy. Right. So there's a little harm done to that connection. And that's okay because we're keeping them safe and we're teaching them lessons. But then if that's all we did, then we're going to harm that connection. But then we need to come back around again. And it could be as simple as saying, building connection by saying, you know what? I see you stomping your feet and I know that you're really angry right now. And it's okay to be angry right now. You want to get in that pond and And I set a boundary that you can't do that. That makes sense. You're angry. Would you like to go for a walk with me? You want a hug? You've just offered connection back, even though you've had to take the stance of power. And so that's with an individual relationship. But I mean, you even think of huge corporations and things taking power over clients and constituents rather than trying to connect with them and build something collaboratively like you're talking about, which is so much better and so much stronger. So
sure.
Cool. Yay.
Yeah. You were just telling that story about a kid wanting to get into a pond and stomping their foot and that sort of thing. And the mom offering that connection piece that was, you know, pulled away from the power piece. Is it a one-to-one? You know, you hear, maybe you've heard this cliche that for every negative thing you say to somebody, you need to say seven positive things to negate the negative thing. That power versus connection, is that a one-to-one, or is there, I took a connection away, now I need to add three in its place?
I don't know. I've never heard anybody that's talking about validating emotions and building connection as much, although I will say Bruce Perry talks about the most benefit kids get is micro moments of connection. He said, you know, you can take your kid to therapy and they're sitting with the therapist. And he said, but what really might have a bigger impact is that night when, you know, the parents looking up something on the phone and the kid asks them and they put their phone down, turn to the kid and say, hey, I really want to hear what you have to say. Let's have a conversation about that. That micro moment might be a lot stronger to help that child become resilient than an hour with a therapist. So what he really talks about is little moments of support and relationship building and how strong that helps overcome all the other pieces, not just power, but also mm-hmm. adversity. So I've never heard them put a number to it though, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. And that makes perfect sense to me. I think even as an adult, those little micro moments of connection matter. They make such a huge difference to me in my relational world with my friends and my partner and, you know, even colleagues.
Absolutely. Yeah. Turning and giving attention to mm-hmm. rather than turning away from. It's just really huge.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about a day in the life at Creating Resilience, that center that you founded?
It's just me. I'm a lone owner, trainer, consultant. Mm-hmm. And because of COVID, I do a lot of my work on Zoom as far as meetings and things like that. I work with schools during staff meetings and on professional development days and present some information as presentations, but then do a lot of work trying to work with them. How are we going to take this knowledge and put it to use? Because mm-hmm. it, you know, if I give them knowledge and they walk out of there and never put it to use, it was a waste of time.
Sure.
So how are we actually going to start putting these strategies and tools and knowledge, awareness of ourselves and awareness of others into practice? So that's something that I do. And I work with small agencies to do that as well. Mm-hmm. Then I do conferences and podcasts and other things as well. I do a lot of volunteer work also, but I'm also part of a voluntary group within the state of Oklahoma, which is similar to, I think, 27 or 28 or maybe even 30 other states across the U.S. Rob Anda was the co-principal investigator of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, and he and a woman named Laura Porter put together a company called ACE Interface. Uh-huh. And then what they do is they go around the country and train volunteer trainers. I'm one of those that will go out and agree to, for free of charge, explain adverse childhood experiences and the study behind that, and then ask and try to get communities to come together mm-hmm. to solve work around that. So I'm not very big on the community end of that. I don't understand community action very well. There's plenty of other people in the state of Oklahoma that do, but I'm the kind of person that if we do that presentation to a school and the school's like, well, now what do we do? Now that we know that this creates this long-term impact, what do we do about it? That's when I'm like, well, you can have me come in, I'll explain the brain and I'll explain how to build attachment and regulation and competency skills and people that have had a lot of adversity. So I create a lot of PowerPoints, a lot of presentations, and then a lot of follow-up to put it all into action.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
It's very fun. Yeah. It's every single one is different. I don't have one set PowerPoint. Every presentation I do is a little bit different.
Oh, I'm sure. I was actually on your website over the weekend prepping for this. And of course, you go down a rabbit hole. You kind of get lost clicking on all the links. And one of the links that I found is an article called Child Maltreatment and Brain Development, a Primer for Child Welfare Professionals. And something that caught my eye that I wanted to ask about speaks to the impact of resilience. I was having a conversation with another presenter 2 or 3 weeks ago who is presenting on Near Science Beyond ACEs. So,
okay, that's part of what I was just talking about.
Yeah, and the resilience we talked a little bit about. This particular article, it says, even in instances when maltreatment does alter children's brain structure or activity, some children do not present any psychopathologies or have outcomes that are much better than expected considering the circumstances they have faced. One recent study found that maltreated children who showed resiliency had different levels of connectivity between various regions of the brain than those who showed symptoms, even though both had the same levels of brain alterations. Can you speak a little bit about that? What would cause that variance in connectivity among the child's brains?
Oh, a lot of things. Genetics does. They are showing that there's a genetic predisposition to resilience and to being more vulnerable to adversity. Mm-hmm. We know that it alters the epigenetics, how our DNA is read and received within our body. And that can change just by luck of that, you know, not luck of the draw, but who you are and the genetics from which you came. Mm-hmm. We also know that the timing of the adversity and abuse and your gender can mm-hmm. play into that. Then the other big key piece is what we're just talking about, the little micro moments. If you're experiencing adversity, mm-hmm. but at the same time you have somebody in your life that is supportive, mm-hmm. that you can talk to, that does give you a sense of worth, you know, that you're worthy, that you can be loved, that the world is a safe place other than this other area, that's a much stronger trajectory towards not having long-term mm-hmm. or even short-term behavioral social issues. So it comes back to what we're talking about, the connection piece and having the resources. So having somebody that you can talk to that makes you feel a little bit more calm and makes you feel like there's some safety in your life. That's what all the research keeps going back to. And so I don't know if you've ever heard of Jennifer Hayes Grudos. She does ACEs and PACEs, and her PACEs is positive and compensatory experiences. She's a researcher at OSU. And I heard her say this once, and I want to give her that plug because I think it was really brilliant. She said, what we do know is that ACEs have the same prevalency around the world. You know, 60% of people, approximately 60 to 65, have experienced one ACE, you know, and I think it's 30 or 40% have experienced four or more ACEs. But she said that the difference is that not everybody has experienced the positive experiences. Sure. And so you could have two people going down the same trajectory. They're experiencing the same thing as children, but this one has a grandparent or a neighbor or a teacher at school or a coach or a babysitter that helps them feel safe and helps them, you know, feel calm in their body for short moments and things like that. And their trajectory is going to be very, very different than someone that never has that. And then you add on all the genetic predisposition and the experiences, you know, are they multiple and daily and ongoing? Or is it that's the thing with the ACEs survey? Why it really can't be used as a diagnostic tool, because I can say I've been physically abused because one time a parent hit me with a belt and made a bruise. Somebody else could say I was physically abused and they were beaten every single day for 7 years.
Right.
One ACE, you know, so yeah. ACEs should not be used as an individual diagnostic tool. They're this epidemiological to look at, hey, look, mm-hmm. all this adversity leads to these risks as an adult, but the risk factor depends on your connectivity to other people, your attachment, your ability to feel safe.
So it sounds like it's more valuable as a dialogue tool than diagnosis.
Absolutely. And you talked to Rob Ando or Vince Valetti that created this. And what Rob Ando says, the ACES survey itself, the only reason he wrote down those 10 questions was to give a presentation about the data.
Oh, wow.
And okay. It got grabbed hold of, and people started using it for diagnostic pieces. And, you know, let's look at your ACEs, and oh, we have all these ACEs and we need to do this. He said it wasn't designed for that. It was an epidemiological study about a population, not about individuals. And so it's really interesting when you get in deep, and that's what the near science is so cool, because you're learning directly from him. And your knowledge base just gets so huge. But that's a big key piece, because I've had people look at it when I was first presenting for TraumaSmart. We go over what the ACEs are, and then I come back a month later, and I came back a month later to this one Head Start, and this teacher came up to me and she grabbed a hold of my hand. She said, "Really need to talk to you. Can we talk before you even start?" I said, "Absolutely. What's going on?" She said, "I have 10 ACEs. Can you refer me? I think I need to go somewhere. I need to get some therapy. I don't want to have cancer. I don't want to have diabetes." And I said, "Well, how do you feel right now?" And she said, "Well, pretty good." And I said, "Are you fairly successful?" And she's like, "Yeah, I'm really successful. I'm really healthy." Da, da, da. I said, "Well, high A score, it's a risk factor. It doesn't mean for sure that's where you're going." And that's what we're about to talk about, is like all these ways that we can help children and young adults prevent those risks from coming true. So Bob Anda says that risk factors are not predictive factors because we have protective factors. And so if you just look at ACEs and say everybody that has 10 ACEs is going to have cancer, heart disease, and diabetes, that's not true. It can't be that predictive on an individual basis because of all these protective factors that we're talking about, you know, learning connectivity and safety and regulation and things like that.
That makes sense. Speaking of learning, you are one of our Zero Mental Health Symposium presenters this year with the theme New Horizons in Brain Science. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you'll be presenting on, the title of your presentation, what it covers, without, of course, giving too much of your presentation away?
Sure. I will really briefly be talking about our brain and how our brains interact with the environment around us and how that might shift whether or not we are able to thoughtfully respond in a circumstance, or our body is going to instinctively react to something around us, and then what triggers are. And I end up really kind of talking about the resilience piece that we've been talking about, and how the awareness of ourself is where we really have to start. Because once we understand where we're functioning in the brain and whether we're thoughtfully responding or instinctively reacting, and know how to kind of shift ourselves in our brain, then it's really hard to teach other people or even to interact with somebody else that's maybe instinctively reacting. So to put that in layman's terms, if you've ever been around somebody that's getting more and more angry and you're getting more and more angry with them and everything just kind of escalates, what this idea is really is that you recognize that person's really angry and I'm not going to jump in where that person is and become angry too. I'm going to be able to regulate myself through whatever means I've learned how to do that, breathing, movement, internal thought process, all these sorts of things, so that when they're getting more angry, I can still thoughtfully respond. Maybe I validate that emotion. Maybe I ask them, you know, how I can help with whatever they're experiencing. And when we can do that and thoughtfully respond, even when other people are reacting, we're building connection. And then it's a teaching moment. We're sharing our calm rather than joining their chaos.
Sure.
That's what it's really about.
Yeah. Cheryl, if anybody wants to find Creating Resilience or read about any of the work that you do, where can they find that?
On my website, creatingresilience.org, just all one word, creatingresilience.org. If you want a lot of information, you can go to the blogs and videos page. And I used to write a lot of blogs for PACES Connection, which is positive and adverse childhood experiences.com, PACESconnection.com. And I have them, it's the links to those blogs. And then it has training topics, different ideas with how I train, and explains the evidence-based model I use for creating resilience, attachment regulation, competency. And my email's all over on every single page. So people can email me if they're interested.
Yeah, there's so much information on there. I was excited to find all of that. Is there anything else you'd like for our listeners to know?
Just that I really believe from the bottom of my heart that if everybody understood the simple pieces of the brain that I'm going to talk about and how to bring calm to our own bodies, it would change the way our world interacts and exists. I've had so many people tell me that they come back, even after just hearing an hour or so, they'll come back and say, my awareness of myself and others has just shifted so much. And I've been able to thoughtfully respond instead of instinctively react to myself and to others. And it's just eye-opening. So I think it's just really fun. I love to watch light bulbs go off.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll be attending the Zero Symposium. So I'm looking forward to seeing your presentation there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Cheryl Stepp and that you walked away with useful insight. Thank you for listening to the Mental Health Download.